to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
You're drowning, and I throw you
well,
a
North Bank Stocks and Jacks. Come out. It's Mr. Dave Scantino on the board. SP Futures up 1.25, and NASDAQ Futures down 38, so we kind of have a mixed opening here. Dow Futures up 78, individual stacks, and the Dow Boeing's up 229, so it's probably most of the 78. Lou, how are you?
I'm very well. Are you guys out looking for the eclipse this morning?
No, but Dave.
And I don't mean the car.
Dave thinks he might have seen the remnants of somebody who probably was looking at it and wrapped into a wall.
Yeah, I actually saw a partial eclipse this morning.
Yeah, yeah. It's I would think over coming up over Lake Michigan, you could get a pretty good look at it. It's a little early here yet, but I'm hopeful I might catch something.
Where do you have to be to get like most of it or a full eclipse?
You have to be north of a line from Churchill, Manitoba to Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Okay. Is it worth the trip?
And I know where Churchill, Manitoba is. I've actually been up there.
God, when I went to see Audrey and I went to see my had an interesting client back in the early 90s that owned a few islands up in the Bay of the Islands. You know where that is? You probably do know where that is.
Is that up in Baffin?
No, it's in, you get the Sault Ste. Marie and turn right. It's on the top part of Lake Huron, and then you turn down into,
okay.
It's a Manitoulin Island, and, is like a part of it, although the difference between the mainland and the island is about 5 feet of water, so I guess it's an island, but, the bridge is about from here to the other side of the office. So we went up there, and it's got the same sort of topography of Quetico. If you ever been up there, even though it's part of technically Lake Huron, you have to be real careful because the glacier came down and scraped like a lot of the landscape off. So there's actually little islands that are like 2 feet underwater. So if you're in a boat, this guy he had like four or five Boston Whalers because they don't draft very much, and they're very solid. So. But he'd be driving along at night, and all of a sudden you'd see like a bird sitting there, and he goes, ah, yeah, there's some bird's eye out, and we'd like go around it. Even he, after being there 30 years, would like drop three or four props a summer. But it's just spectacular views and stuff, and I mean, the sound, you'd be on one island, and, you know, some dog would bark like, 2 miles away, and you'd hear it, over the water. It was really crazy stuff, but...
I can tell you that Churchill, Manitoba is... not particularly scenic. I mean, it's muskeg, and do you know what muskeg is?
No. Is that like tundra?
I believe it might be a Canadian term, but anyway, it's a swampy, flat kind of tundra. It's nightmare to walk through, unless it's frozen solid, which it usually is most of the time. Not much up at Churchill, Manitoba, except polar bears. Which come into town, by the way. In the spring.
Oh, that's cool.
The line that they're talking about for the eclipse, as I said, runs from Churchill to Halifax, so it cuts across northern Manitoba, northern Ontario, and then goes down into Quebec, pretty deeply to Quebec, and then obviously across the St. Lawrence Seaway at the close to a mouth and then into Halifax. So, the Prince Edward Island, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia are probably getting a pretty good look at this thing. But it's a fairly narrow band. I think it's only about 300 miles wide.
It's always like a real narrow spot.
It's going to be a
full one. I mean, whenever you see the guys that chase this stuff, they're always going to like South America or India or someplace. It's always like a pretty narrow spot you have to be.
Yeah, and this is a ring of fire eclipse, which, as I understand it, means that the moon is not quite covering the sun. It's a total, it's a complete covering of the sun's surface by the moon, but there's a section of the sun that is not covered because of the distance and the angle, so that you get this ring of fire look around the sun. But for you guys, less so for me because I'm further away from the epicenter. But for you guys, you got to be looking up. You should be able to see a bite taken out of the sun.
Well, yeah, that's what I saw this morning. It was pretty cool.
And the guy took the bite out of the wall with his car.
Oh, he did. I guarantee
that's right.
I missed it by 10 seconds because everyone slowed down and to see the sun, and this guy was in the wall.
Well, the comment made by this guy's son when we went up there was, you drive along upper part of Lake Huron, and you get to this one road, and you turn right down to Manitoulin Island. He said, if you turn left, you go all the way to Hudson's Bay, and all you got are moose and mosquitoes. There's like nothing between one and the other. I mean,
that sounds about right.
Yeah, it's.
I got a couple of sports stories that also interact with legal stuff, and I wanted to just start with one that's local here. There's a kid up here, and I had mentioned this name, Juwan James. He's a tackle, plays for the Broncos. And following the National Football League Players Association advice, he did not go in and to the team facility to do his workouts in the off season. And the NFL, you know, was telling the players, look, you guys need to come in to the facility to do the workouts so we can monitor them. The Players Association said no. I'm not sure why. I think the claim was that it was COVID related, but again, the stupidity over COVID, especially as it relates to a bunch of very healthy young men, is beyond belief. But in any event, the union told them no, and the clubs had taken the position based on guidance from the league that injuries that took place outside of the practice facilities were not football related, and therefore not, if you got wrecked doing this stuff, you were not going to be entitled to your salary, and in fact you were in danger of having your contract canceled. So this kid, I think he snaps an Achilles tendon doing workouts away from the facility. The Broncos, you know, said, okay, well, that's a $10 million contract that we can void right now. And I think they waited a couple of days, but then they voided the kid's contract and cut him. So he has now filed a grievance against the Broncos, alleging that, in fact, his injuries were football-related because he was under the guidance of his coaches and talking to them on a regular basis when he was doing the workouts. But more importantly, he's alleging some kind of collusive activity between the teams because the NFL issued this guidance telling the clubs, look, from our perspective, these kinds of injuries are not football-related, specifically work-related. And it raises some really interesting questions, and this thing has not really become the cause celeb, but I think it could be. You would think there would be, that this kid would be beating the drums and his agent would be beating the drums to get this in front of the public to say, look how unfair this is. These meanies at the NFL are not going to, you know, pay me even though I got wrecked.
So the guy's not, the guy's
pursuit of my obligation to play.
So the guy's not supposed to go out for, if he's next to a park, he can't go for a jog in the morning. He's got to go to the facility, or else if something happens, he doesn't get any, he's out.
If he's typically engaged in activity that is unrelated to his football status, and he gets hurt, then the club is under no obligation to take care of him.
Well, I mean,
and that's what happened here.
So if he's jogging in the park and somehow steps in a hole or something weird happens, they're not paying.
Yep, they can void the contract unless he's got some kind of guaranteed language built in there, and you know, guaranteed contracts, especially for you know, people who aren't named Aaron Rodgers or Tom Brady, are few and far between.
Well, what is the contract?
Something like this.
What does the contract actually say? And what if you? I mean, it's not something you can cross out and put an initial next to it, I assume.
Well, you can, but the club's not going to sign it. The player, the contract comes to the player. The player signs it and then returns it to the team, which then signs it and sends it back to the player and says, okay, here's your copy. If the agent, for example, crosses out language that the agent doesn't like, or the player doesn't like, then the club, you know, typically says, well, we're not signing this.
Well, if every club says that, then that's a problem. Because these guys don't...
Yeah, well,
They don't.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you're playing in the National Football League, you're a team in the National Football League, and you get legal advice. I mean, they're not obligated to do this. They could give this kid an act of grace and say, look, we're going to pay it anyway, even though it was a non-football related injury. But legal advice from the league, I don't think counts as collusive activity.
Well, what I'm saying is, I've always felt that the NFL, and I don't think baseball should have an antitrust exemption, but they didn't ask me. But football doesn't have one, and if you were somebody just sitting there in Mars, if there are people up there, you would not know by the way they act. The NFL sure acts like they have one.
They do have one.
Well, no, they don't.
Yes, they do.
They don't have one from Congress like baseball. But
they've got an antitrust. Well, actually, they do have an antitrust. Well, let's see.
No.
I think it is from Congress, but in any event,
no, they have
it's definitely an exemption.
They have.
So does the NHL. So does.
They have
the NBA.
They have a. I'm debating you on this, which is crazy.
You don't remember the very first time you brought me on the show in 2011. This is what we talked about.
The antitrust
exemption that exists for multi-employer units that have a collective bargaining agreement.
It's not the same as the baseball one, which is a congressional.
It operates exactly the same as the baseball one, but it requires the existence of a union. Baseball's does not.
Wasn't when the two leagues got together, wasn't it just a small cutout that said they could market together or something? It was nowhere near as strong starting out as baseball. They've walked it up as they've gone. Is that what they've done?
No. What happened was once they had a union in place, the union provides the cover for the quote unquote antitrust activity. So if there's a collective bargaining agreement in place, a union contract with a bunch of employers, specifically in this case the teams, if there's a collective bargaining agreement in place, the union and the group of teams are allowed to bargain all together to do things like fix compensation, to fix benefits and terms and conditions of employment. And they can fix all of that within this multi-employer bargaining unit as long as the union is in play. This is what happened in 2011, if you remember. The NFL Players Association dissolved in 2011 and then filed antitrust charges against the league.
I remember that.
And won at the trial court level. They got reversed at the Eighth Circuit, but they won at the trial court level.
Why would it get reversed?
It was reversed because the Eighth Circuit said the union dissolved, quote-unquote dissolved. The union still existed, and they were still negotiating. But the union dissolved and said, we're no longer representing these players. The multi-bargaining unit exception is gone, and the clubs are fixing compensation and all this other stuff, and they filed a lawsuit, and they wanted to enjoin the clubs from locking the players out.
Well, what is the trial court? Explain to me the economic connection between having a union and being able to have an antitrust exemption and all the other stuff. What does anything have to do with anything? Like not letting another team in the league and all those kinds of things, and somebody wants in. I mean, what does that have to do with having a union? I mean, what kind of government do we have? There's no connection there whatsoever.
Well, no, this has been in place since the National Labor Relations Act was passed in the 1930s. And it was put into place specifically, and it's been found to be in place specifically, because without it, you can't have these multi-employer bargaining units. And the multi-employer bargaining units are important because they allow unions to negotiate, and they empower the employees represented by the unions. They empower them to negotiate terms and conditions of employment with more leverage than they could if they had to go one employer at a time within a certain industry.
I don't want to kill this one to death here, but educate me. The auto workers say, well, I'll go back in a day when they had three employers. All right. Now, just because they got to bargain with the three employers didn't mean that Chrysler and Ford could fix prices.
No, but because those weren't multi-employer bargaining units. Those were three separate employers.
Well, but they acted the same way. The same deal went to every different place, even though it ended up in the same place.
The union leveraged. They would negotiate a deal against whatever of the automakers when those contracts were coming up. The union would go after whichever one of the automakers it thought was the weakest and try to secure the best deal. And then it would take that contract to the other two of the big three and say, you got to pay this. And then you'd have fights. I mean, you remember the labor strike of the 1970s and 1980s over the stuff.
But if it looked like a duck and quacks like a duck, I mean, it's sort of the same thing. Because Delphi had the same stuff. The parts makers had the same stuff. They ended up all in the same place, Lou. They all ended up with the same hospitalization and all. Right?
They were different employers, and therefore there was no antitrust exemption.
Well, my point is...
The union did not negotiate with all of them at the same time.
I could easily make a point that the Indianapolis Colts are a different employer than the Bears.
Oh, they are. They are a different employer, and that's but they're all covered under the aegis of this single employment contract.
I think they're covered under the fact that our idiotic representatives and senators think we all love football and they all got paid off. I'm kind of on a rant here this morning, and this just happens.
What are you not on a rant at this hour of the morning? This is what happens when the Stocks and Jocks World Headquarters breakfast buffet got screwed up by COVID. This is what happens. We get a grumpy chief.
Well, I was, we've been through various people, Carl, you somewhat, Kevin, we've been tracing the history, I won't say beating the horse, tracing the history of these companies that have essentially offloaded all the stuff from this country. Your chip manufacturers and people have decided to go elsewhere because they don't have any sort of pollution issues, and they get cheaper people and all those kinds of things. So now
the cost of production are less.
Now they decide they want them back. Well, yeah, but of course we're paying off politicians in China. You know, you have to pay people off to get your factory after years and years to only be 30 cents an hour. Well, you can't just that doesn't happen normally. That's why your people like Milton Friedman and people who encourage this kind of foreign expansion, thinking that these countries would be like us, and you would essentially have higher wages over there, and what you were doing is you were developing customers. Well, that didn't happen. I mean, you ask yourself, why is the guy in the Chevy factory in Mexico still making $3 an hour that he made 30 years ago? The answer is, some cartel or some government or somebody does the labor beat-up job for you, right? But now my point is, these people did this. Now, we know there's reasons, Lou, and I'm not going to, condemn them all.
But let me just because we're going to go way off track here. Let me just go back to where I started the conversation. The Broncos cut this kid.
Right.
The important thing is not the workout or the non-football related injury issue, because I think the team's got a pretty good claim there that this was not a football related injury, and in fact, the players had been specifically warned by the league, don't do this, because if you do and you get hurt, we're not going to take it. So the smart players went out and bought insurance against a non-football injury. I don't know whether this gentleman has it or not, but the key issue here from my perspective is this idea of collusion and whether the league issuing an opinion, a legal opinion, to its clubs saying you can enforce these off-season workout requirements, and the way you enforce them is by voiding contracts if people get injured. There's actually two of these cases that I'm aware of now, but the James one is the big one. And whether that's collusive conduct under the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. It's going to be interesting because this will go to arbitration.
Lou, when's the last time in anything like this, especially with all the COVID crap we've seen, when's the last time that you saw somebody write, do research, legal research or otherwise, where he didn't already know what the conclusion was when he started the project?
I don't know what the answer is going to be on this. That's going to be up to the arbitrator.
I'm talking about the legal opinion. They knew what the answer was going to be out of this, whoever did it, before he started.
What happened was you had a large segment of the minute the Players Association took the position that you should go in, the players should not go in to work out at their team facilities, the club said, we want them here so that we can control what they're doing. We got training staff, we got the medical help, we've got, you know, workout conditions that we control absolutely. We're not responsible if you go down to 24-hour fitness, or Gold's Gym and get hurt. So the clubs took that position in response to the Players Association telling the players not to go into the facility and work out. And I put the onus of this on the Players Association, which should have been saying, okay, fine. For those of you that aren't going to go in and work out, we're going to buy insurance policies for you guys, or we're going to get you discount insurance or whatever. This is a terrible ball drop on the part of the union as far as I'm concerned.
I'm sure you're right. What percentage... No, I'll hit you with one. What percentage of all NFL players, I'm going to include Aaron Rodgers, he doesn't even like Green Bay, live with any kind of commuting distance to their workout facility?
I have no idea.
I'm going to say 20%.
In the off season, a lot of them do because they go in to work out. They have a place somewhere where they go until the OTAs start. And then they come in and start working out with the club.
Well, how many of the Bears do you think, 60-man roster, you think live in the Chicago area? I mean, I don't know. Chicago's a nice town, but how many people live in Buffalo or Green Bay in the wintertime?
Well, I would think it'd be, you know, major cities, you'll have more players closer to the facilities.
I would agree. I would say that, too, but I don't know. It's I'm asking.
You'll excuse me for saying that. At least in the case of this gentleman from the Broncos, a $10 million salary means you pretty much go to work where you're going to go to work.
Yeah, probably. I mean,
in other words, the employer's paying these guys enough money that the employer can fairly say you need to be here when we're doing these workouts.
Right, I get it. I mean, but I find it hard to believe that a seriously conditioned, and these guys are top drawer athletes, someplace somewhere that he goes for 2 weeks to Hawaii on vacation in the wintertime, just sits on his ass on the sofa and doesn't even go out for a jog. I mean, you're going to do something wherever you are, right? I mean, these guys are they're not sitting
Chief,
on the
Chief. I will tell you, every one of the players that I counseled when I was an agent, every one of them, one of the first things I told them is that if they sign the NFL contract, we need to buy insurance because you are literally a step off a curb away from ending your career.
Right. Oh, I don't disagree. My question, I guess, is if you were the attorney representing this kid, I'm going to say the first thing you would do is find out if anybody else is in a like situation and if they paid the guy. I mean, obviously they paid. I'm sure they've paid other people that they just want to keep.
Well,
if the guy's cheap enough, they'll pay him. They must think this guy's at $10 million. They don't want him anymore.
He's actually not bad. I think that this was a fairly clear shot by the Broncos across the bow of the rest of the team, saying if you don't come in here and you get hurt, We're not paying you. And it's a hard line. I'm sort of surprised that they took it, but it also wouldn't surprise me if in 3 months or 4 months after everybody gets into training camp and the impact of this decision has faded a little bit, that the Broncos go back to this tackle and say, all right, now we'll talk to you about paying you for whatever. But they cut him. I mean, that's
the same thing the Bulls did with the guy with the motorcycle crash. The guy with the motorcycle crash from the Bulls. But, Lou, it could be as simple as, do we really want to pay...
Williams, right?
Yeah, do we really want to pay somebody $10 million that's got a bum Achilles? And the answer is no.
No.
Right? I don't. I mean, when, right. You know, he might come back 2 years from now, and he might be 80%. I don't want to pay him $10 million. I'm not even a Bronco fan, but I'm saying I don't want to pay the guy $10 million. And he hurt his foot. Do you?
No, I mean, I think that all factors into it. Again, the failure here. I mean, the clubs may be colluding for all I know, but I think the collusion argument in the context of getting legal advice from the league is a loser. But I also understand why they threw that out there. They're trying to get leverage to get this kid something. I think the real screw up here is the league or the Players Association, which should have gone out to every one of these guys and said, if you are not going to go to OTAs and you're going to do workouts on your own, then here's the insurance policy we want you to have, and we'll fund 50% of it or whatever.
Yeah, I would agree. SP Futures down a quarter, and NASDAQ is down 37. Again, the big CPI numbers this morning, so we could get a jolt around 7:30. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Welcome to Luckbox. The control freaks guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Harrell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
Right now. Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Alley, just Dave Scatino on the board. S&P futures down 375 now. NASDAQ's down 60. Again, we're waiting for these CPI numbers, which everybody thinks are going to be horrible. But don't worry, the Fed's still going to keep pouring money into the system. I don't know about that. We'll see. I think these guys change their tone as soon as they find out they're out of control and they're going to panic. I see too many of them on TV. They look like the panicking kind. What do you think, David? Just saying.
Right.
They look like panickers. DAX down $5, call that flat. FTSE up 15.2%. CAC down 18.3%. So they're kind of waiting over there as well. Remember, for years and years, these numbers didn't mean anything. All of a sudden, the last few months, they mean something. Nikkei up 97.3%. Shanghai up 19.5%. Hang Seng down 3, call that flat. Yesterday, we ducked down on the close. We were flat to up most of the day, but in the close, we ducked. We've been selling off kind of into the close really now for a couple of weeks. Nothing heavy, but just we seem weak on the close, which to me indicates not a whole lot of mutual fund buying. So I don't know what that means, but we don't seem to have that much lately. Dow Jones down 152 yesterday, S&P down 7, NASDAQ down 13. The bonds, we're 1.49, so we're actually up. We had a 10-year auction yesterday, where the 10-year rate went out. It was oversubscribed by a lot, like 2-point-something, and it was under 1.49. And I looked upon that, and I said, you know what, I think this is it. The Fed probably bought half of them. I don't know. I'll find out. We'll find out somewhere, I guess. But I have a feeling that that's it on these bonds. That could be the top yesterday. We'll see. Because all of a sudden this number comes in hot today, I don't see how they go any further that direction. But one minus 0.23. The Japan, these guys are ducking back down towards zero. They're positive 0.04. They were positive 0.08 or 9 forever. Now they've ducked 3 basis points this morning. Oil up 12 cents, 70.08, still hanging above 70. Brent up 23 cents, 72.45. Natural gas up a penny, 3.14. RBOB unchanged, 2.21. Gold is down $15, 18.80. Silver down 22 cents, 27.78, which is real interesting if you get a CPI number of like almost 5, like they're talking about. Copper down 6 cents, 4.46. And our favorite crypto is up 1,600, back up to 37,000. It's had a big run the last couple days. So it's back up at the top end. Actually, probably broke through the range of 32 to 36. It's almost 38. David, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Good morning. 37 in Chicago. Today's weather, currently it's 68 and sunny. We're going to see a high of 76 and sunny with partly clouds. To our Phoenix listeners, it's 76 and clear this morning, and they will get to 102, mostly sunny. Traffic, there's some a mess on I-80. I-80 West closed between I-55s and exit 126 and Ridge Road due to a rollover semi. There's also an accident on I-55 North that was earlier before the Des Plaines River stop-and-go traffic. And usual long-term construction on the Eisenhower and Kennedy slowdowns. In sports, NBA playoffs. The Suns take a 2-0 lead, defeating Denver 123-98. In the MLB last night, Sox lose to the Blue Jays 6-2, and they take on the Blue Jays at home today. The Cubs beat Padres 3-1, and they're off today. Diamondbacks drop another one, losing 4-0 to the A's. NHL playoffs continue, and in the PGA, the Palmetto Championship in South Carolina this weekend. Back to you, Chief.
So if Ricky Fowler wins this one, does he get in the Open?
I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up.
I bet he's maybe not even in this one because he was at the U.S. Open qualifier and didn't make it.
Yeah, I'll have to look it up.
A shot short, David.
Yeah.
What can I say?
That happens.
So Lou, yeah, I was, my kind of ranting here is that it's sort of like, I was outraged at this $250 billion bipartisan bill for this Chinese competition. So, we let firms essentially combine, become oligarchies or whatever, and they become inefficient, it appears, send stuff overseas, and then all of a sudden we have a shortage, and now our solution is to give money back to those firms to try and bring stuff back here. Lou, do we think that maybe it's somewhere along the line we got to get some different people or some other companies involved, or we just got to go to the same people all the time? How do you get to one of these days? I mean, I sure wish. Actually, I don't, because I have some concept of right and wrong. But somewhere along the line, you got to get a firm, and I'll put PTI in that. You got to get to the size to where the regulators and the people in office think you're like part of the system, to where your regulators will, instead of screwing the small firms and making life miserable for them, you got to reach that point where they think you're part of the system, and they look the other way at any bad thing you do. I mean, how do you know where that line is, and how do you just cross it? Are people ever let you cross it, or is it so rare that they let somebody into the club? Has everything become a club now? I mean, is it the football owners? Is it now the 10 big, you know, trading firms that they get to do stuff without any sort of looking? Did you hear the two guys come on TV yesterday sniveling, where the new SEC chairman is making big noise about taking another look at payment for order flow and the 17 different exchanges where you preference stuff and move all around? The two guys that came on talking about what spectacular institutions these big firms are that are selling people's order flow and getting kickbacks. I mean, it's what spectacular human beings they are. And the reason why they still wear shirts and ties is so their heart doesn't pop out of their chest. Do we really have to listen to this crap? Just saying.
Sure we do. And let me give you another example. And this, I mean, I got two really good unfairness stories to tell you, and I'll talk about the first one now. You know what BlackRock is, the investment company?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You know what they've been buying? You know what they've been doing?
Well, they do all kinds of stuff that I don't necessarily approve of. What specifically now?
Okay. Well, so BlackRock is one of those social justice, socially aware companies that pushes the what I consider to be the social justice warrior ethic in its business practices, or at least they put it out there. Perhaps they're just virtue signaling, but they have been buying up, along with several other large investment groups, they have been buying up individual residential properties throughout the United States in bulk. So, for example, here in Denver, although I'm not sure how much of the market they own in Denver, but here in Denver, the real estate market is incredibly tight. If you come in to buy a house, you're a homeowner and you want to look to buy a house, if BlackRock has targeted that property, you better be prepared to waive inspection and pay 20 to 35% more above the asking price, because that's what they're doing. And they are purchasing thousands of these houses. They are literally distorting the housing market in particular areas where there's hot real estate like Nashville or Denver, and going in and buying up hundreds of homes and literally skewing the market. The point is they're buying these things for rental purposes. And you're starting to see some alarm in housing policy circles at the fact that it's going to be virtually impossible for the individual homeowner or a person who, say, is in an apartment and they want to make an investment in the home, you know, because that traditionally has been the mechanism for how people move up in terms of social status and financial status, is they buy a house. And that gets equity for them and investment, and it's something they can use at the same time. The presence of operations like BlackRock, and Dave, you could pull this up. It's all over the press right now. The presence of investment groups like BlackRock effectively shuts down that upward mobility in markets where they've entered in. And all they're not reselling these houses. They are not fixing them up. They're not turning them or flipping them. They are buying them and holding them as rental properties, and they're keeping them as rental properties. And this goes to a whole bunch of things that you and I have talked about, one of which is the incredible power of wealthy firms and the concentration of wealth in a few investment groups gives them leverage to do things that, you know, our public policy people have never really contemplated. It gives them a footprint and an economic impact way in excess of anything that was contemplated by the regulators at the time these companies were chartered.
I'm going to say, Lou, that I'm going to disagree with you vehemently on one thing and one thing only, because I agree with you on everything else. But I have to disagree once in a while, just because once in a while I get to top the Lou. You know, it's very rare, but once in a while I do. I'm going to say it's not...
It's a regular event, for heaven's sake.
No, it isn't. I'm going to say that even though you were around at the time, you were chasing Catherine Bell in the, around the JAG office, look at your Resolution Trust and the amount of properties GE came out of Resolution Trust. The Resolution Trust made GE Capital. They were the BlackRock. Yes. They were the BlackRock of the time. But I'm going to say that the BlackRock is why they're doing this. I'm going to give you a totally different idea on this. Is you and everybody else, and you don't believe them, but listen to these bumps on TV talk about this inflation is transitory. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. BlackRock maybe has some old fart like me at their place nodding in their ear. This inflation is going to get out of hand. The 20% or 15% up you think they're paying is going to be a bargain 2 years ago if the Fed doesn't change their mind. We're talking, I mean, where do you think that house is going to be if it's worth 180 and these guys pay 190 and you're kind of appalled by it? I'm going to say with 10% inflation for 4 years by the time these guys figure it out, that house will be worth 300 3 years from now.
Yep. Well, no, I understand. I think I understand why they're doing it. Then it's exactly the reason you described. I assume that they're putting money into it, not for some nefarious purpose other than making more money.
Yeah. Oh,
it's just that the impact they're having, they're not buying, 50 properties. They're coming in and taking whole neighborhoods. They've purchased entire developments of 200, 300, 400 homes that are coming on market from a developer. And again, I assume it's for that reason, but the impact that they're having is dramatic in terms of the ability of, again, those folks who are, say, in the lower half of the economic ladder, who want to move up. They're foreclosing that in the near term.
The lower class population, middle class on down.
Which I made a little play on words there, yeah. Didn't I?
Yeah,
they're foreclosing that in the near term.
Yeah, but I'd say that the 0.6 percentile to zero right now probably has less of a political voice than they had up until maybe when Roosevelt came in. And they have no voice, Lou, none whatsoever.
The great irony of the people screaming about income inequality right now is that income inequality actually went down under Donald Trump because of the economy performing very well for minority, minority workers. So the unemployment rate dropped, these folks started accumulating some real capital, and the income inequality levels, at least as measured by our government, the income inequality levels actually fell. It's going right back up again now. Why wouldn't it?
Well,
it skyrocketed under Obama, and we've got the same guys running the show now.
Don't be one of the Republican people that turn the facts into their try and turn the facts because of their argument. The fact is, if you take the last 7 years of the Obama administration all the way through Trump before COVID, and even if you keep adding the numbers in. With this guy, you're going to find that your unemployment, your amount of people going back to work, is pretty much the same under all of them. And it wasn't.
I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying that under Trump, and I'm not necessarily giving him credit. I'm just saying it's ironic. Under Trump, whatever the reason, whatever the cause, income inequality declined.
I'll give you one better. My Hispanic friends tell me it was actually easier to get here from Mexico if you were legitimate under Trump than it was before.
Oh, I believe that. Absolutely.
So, you can't always believe what you see or hear, can you?
No. All right, so let me give you the next unfairness story.
Oh, wait, let me make one more.
A little time.
Well, one more point on this. Who do you think has a greater influence on the Fed not stopping this ridiculous policy? You or me or BlackRock?
Oh, BlackRock.
Yeah. I mean, it's a... But now that's in Chicago.
That's where those campaign contributions go.
Oh, yeah. Now in Chicago, the same thing is happening, although I think it's happening less because I think they're giving up on some of these neighborhoods. But here, they're just buying a property for in Inglewood in the West Side for like tax stuff. And my elves tell me that for a while it was a group out of Ireland that was buying. We're not paying. These guys aren't BlackRock. They're not paying up, Lou. They're stealing the stuff out of like the tax collections and any kind of program where you can buy a vacant lot for 100 years. Now you and I,
sure.
If we walked down to City Hall, even though you're an esteemed attorney, you're going to look good in a suit. If we walk in and say, by the way, where's the room where we can buy the vacant lots for $100? I don't think they're going to tell us where the room is. I just have a
no.
David, you think they're going to give us that? Then all of a sudden we walk in and there's normally three people there, and now there's four, and we get a fair shake at buying some of these. I'm thinking no, but the same thing's happening here. Little groups of people are grabbing whole areas of these houses. Now they're on the several generation plan, right? Because they're like the University of Chicago. They're like DePaul. It says we plan on being here for 200 years, so. We don't care. We're going to buy this property, and we're going to continue to expand the base because we don't want the bad neighborhood near us or anything like that.
Right.
University of Chicago's been doing that since the 70s. So, it kind of happens sort of everywhere.
Makes sense.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
All right. So let me go with the next unfairness story. It's sort of unfair. I'm sort of torn. All right. So this hits a little closer to home. Service academies, you know, where Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, Merchant Marine, at least the ones that operate under the DOD, which in times of peace are Air Force, Army, and Navy, have a policy that allows their cadets to basically defer the what's called the active duty service commitment, the service commitment that each cadet accepts when they graduate from the place, and defer that if the cadet signs a contract with a major league sports team. So if a cadet at Air Force, for example, or an Army or Navy signs a hockey contract with an NHL team, or a baseball contract, or a football contract in this case, then the service secretaries, and it's an individual service thing, have the ability to go to the Secretary of Defense with a recommendation saying, we want this cadet who's been signed by, let's say, the New York Giants to defer his commissioning. Or we'll commission him, but he's going to defer his active duty. The kid's going to try out and play. He'll go into the reserves. He will serve as a reserve officer X number of days a week or X number of days a month. While he's playing football, we'll extend the reserve commitment. Instead of 5 years, we're going to get 7 or 8 years out of him as a reserve officer. And he'll continue to perform his duties. There are a variety of ways of managing it, but that's typically the way it goes.
Just like the Roger Staubach rule, or what?
Yeah, yeah. What? I mean, it's the David, what's his face from Navy was one of the first test cases on this.
Oh, the captain or the admiral,
the basketball player,
the admiral David.
Yeah, the admiral.
That was his last name.
Robinson.
Dave Robinson. So, yeah.
So. Navy has a kid who, by the way, I don't think any of the service academies had football players drafted this year.
Well, wait a second. David Robinson had a slight exception in that he was in the Submariner service, and when he grew to be 6'9", he outgrew the service.
Well, he actually served on active duty.
But not in a Submariner,
for a couple
I don't
of
think.
Years.
He'd be bonking his head.
No. No, he was... He was. I think they moved into surface warfare. But in any event, these guys, this deferment is. It used to be you had 2 years on active duty, and then you could go in. Now they allow him to go in directly. So this kid from Annapolis doesn't get drafted, but he gets signed by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and he's one of I think four service academy graduates, maybe five. Three from Air Force, one from Army, and then this kid from Navy, who signed. Football contract. So he's signed, he's now eligible for this program. The other service academy grads, all of them, have been cleared by their service secretaries to defer their active duty time and go play football. The Secretary of the Navy tells this Annapolis kid, no, we're not going to do that for you. You're going to get commissioned. Give up the football and you're going to get commissioned. Now, there are lots of good reasons for the services to allow these kids to go play pro football. Publicity is the main one. you know, a kid who's a service academy grad is a story on whichever football team he joins, and it's a lot of free publicity for the services and for the service academies to have these guys out there in the NFL. And you know, there's any number of examples I can cite, but every time one of these guys steps on the field and makes a play, the fact that he's a service academy grad typically gets mentioned, and it's a big deal. So there's a lot of good reasons to turn him loose. There are also very good policy reasons not to. And so,
well, what if the guy was a genius chemist? He's got to go. We're not going to do that for him. But if he's a quarterback, it's okay.
I'm sorry.
What if the guy was a genius chemist or physicist? We're not going to let him out of service. But if he's a quarterback, it's okay.
Basically, yeah.
Well, there might be a few people that don't agree with that.
Well, I mean, especially given the fact that these kids are getting something like a $400,000 education at taxpayer expense.
Right.
With the understanding that they are going to get commissioned and go serve their country.
I'd feel better if the football team gave the service academy $500,000 in return.
That helps.
Yeah.
But you know, that's the trade-off. I mean, when you enter a service academy, you understand, I mean, I played football at Air Force, you understand that you're there to get a commission.
Right.
Your football is secondary. You know, the only thing that is primary is your classes, staying eligible, your conduct so that you stay eligible, and then you're getting the commission.
Well, can I ask a personal curiosity, because I read, George Marshall, Soldier and Statesman. So what is the connection, or how tight is the connection? I mean, you just rattled off all the service academies between the actual armed forces and like VMI and the Citadel and places like that. Because the VMI was like there actually was an active duty guy that was the head of that for a long time, right? And it was a big job. Was he like an active colonel or general? Are they somewhat tied at the hip, those places in the Army?
Not really, no. The cadets at VMI, the cadets at the Citadel, if they want to get commissioned, they go through ROTC, just like anybody else in an undergraduate program. Now, those programs are very rigorous.
Was it different in Marshall's time? It seemed like there was a huge connection where he was like offered the job at VMI and it was like a big deal. I mean, to be the head of it.
I think that, but Marshall was not active duty when he was offered that.
I mean, it was years later. It was like a career choice. I mean, like he didn't turn that down.
Yeah, right. He went on to become Secretary of State, but he did not. He was not on active duty. The ROTC commanders at those institutions are active duty officers, but the actual superintendents, my understanding is typically is no.
They're
usually retired.
What's the connection with like a big ROTC school? Like, actually, Notre Dame's a big ROTC school. I mean, who are the people there?
Texas A&M.
Yeah,
those are big ROTC schools, but they're not, you know, they're not service academies, and there's a different circumstance, and those kids are commissioned under different circumstances.
Okay.
Now, they all come in as the same status, but the service academy graduates, you know, ROTC, you can back out, I think, all the way up to, you know, your senior year, and you only repay them a minor amount of training costs. The service academies, you're locked in after your sophomore year,
okay,
and you have to complete the school. And if you don't, you either repay or you go on active duty as an enlisted person for 5 years.
Well, you can get an ROTC scholarship, but it might only be, you know, a quarter of your tuition, right? It's not the whole ball. I mean, you don't pay anything for the Air Force, right?
No, you don't. The service academy graduates pay nothing. So this kid is now, you know, harping on the fact that, hey, what's different about me? I had this expectation. I had all this. And the point that I was going to make on this, you know, is sort of that, let's take that little Irish girl on the YouTube video. How is this fair? And I remember thinking to myself, because I dealt with a couple of guys like this, that, you know, this happens every time. You extend a privilege to these guys, and the privilege is we're going to make exceptions, or we can make exceptions for you guys under very specific circumstances, and it has to be, you know, everything has to line up. That exception, that privilege, and that's what the exception is. A privilege has now become an expectation. You know, the idea that is all I got to do is get signed and I'm out.
Well,
and you know, this is sort of a wake up call saying, you know, really, no, us letting you out of the contract that you signed to become an officer in the Navy, that's our expectation.
Well,
anything varying from that is an act of grace on our part.
Well,
and here's the wake up call that it's not. And I don't know the circumstances with this young man. My understanding is he was an exemplary cadet and midshipman, excuse me, and you know, towed the line and did everything right and did real well for the football program and all that. But you know, this is just sort of a welcome to the machine, you know, welcome to the military establishment, where what you want and even, quite frankly, what we told you yesterday can change at the drop of a hat.
I guarantee you, Lou, that if he was going to become the Alabama quarterback, they'd have found a way out for him.
Say again, if he had what?
If he was going to be the new Alabama or quarterback at some place where there was connections, that he'd be out.
I don't know. This...
Well, we gotta go, bud. Let's kick this. Yeah, you're right. You gotta remember, I'm from Chicago. There's always a guy behind it somehow. Take care of yourself, bud. We'll talk next week. Keep your eye on these numbers. They'll be out in a half hour. SP Futures down a buck. NASDAQ Futures down 46. Right back, Mr. Dan Janinas.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices, along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allies, Mr. Dave Scatina on the board. SP Futures down 75 cents, NASDAQ down 42. We're half hour away from the CPI number, but I have a interesting piece of news. Here's ECB leaves rates and bond buying unchanged despite inflation uptick. Monetary players want answers on how long the central bank will keep up its vast monetary stimulus. The ECB is committed to purchasing 1.85 trillion euros, that's $2.2 trillion, of bonds until March 2022 as part of the pandemic energy purchase program. And they have, Christine Lagarde, who I think is about as crooked as they get, or she's in that. Let's put it this way, she's manipulated as they get. Anybody tell me, you know, what the world's going to look like if the same people you're giving money to at 2.2% get to go buy up all this stuff out of other people that other people now earn, and in 2 or 3 years from now, what the world's going to look like? It's going to be even more concentrated. What's wrong with these people? They've got negative interest. Dan, get me off this rant, will you, for God's sake.
Okay.
Yeah, well, we do have CPI, and I think more importantly, we have the jobs report coming out at 8:30 as well. This morning, I think the jobs report maybe were a little more of the focus is looking at, you know, this continued path that we've had, a very positive development and employment, and getting people back to work and all that. So the there is, I agree with you, the what's happening here in the U.S., I mean, there is talk about cutting back the repurchase of mortgage bonds here. You know, the fact that that hasn't happened is part of the reason that we've seen the 10-year Treasury continue to drop while we have signs of inflation. And as you mentioned, obviously, in Europe, they basically follow us. And so they're a little bit behind, but they're, you know, not looking to taper at any time soon as well. So the picture is clear that there is inflation. That's what we're seeing. Transitory or not, it's there. It is definitely in the supply chain. It's definitely in the, you know, we will start seeing it, you know, wages ticking up. It's definitely in raw materials. All the companies I'm speaking to are seeing it. They're able to increase prices. You know, it's certainly if you go to Home Depot or if you're building, you're seeing it pretty much across the board. And each week that goes by, I see it in more places than I did the prior week. So I do think that this is a trend, and I don't know how, there may be some of it that's transitory, but I think that once higher wages start to stick, higher gas prices, for example, are starting to stick. This is, you know, we're in this part of the credit cycle where this happens, and this is exactly what's going on. So one other development that we saw this week, and I'm going to kind of use this as an idea to give, you know, to present some opportunities. We've seen this, you know, this crazy meme stock buying, the speculative buying of names like AMC and Wendy's, and you know, kind of the opposite of what we do, where we don't chase momentum. We actually do our homework to come up with names that have good return, long-term potential, and all that. And we're looking at fundamentals. Well, we had two stocks this week, just in the last 2 days, that were up close to 40%. One of them was U.S. Concrete, and that was an acquisition by Vulcan Materials. And that was a nice run and a nice, you know, we knew that they were potentially on the block, but they're, you know, a well-run company in the infrastructure business. We like infrastructure. We think it's a good play here long-term. We're not looking to make money on gameplay you know, the flavor of the day, if you will. We're looking to make money on names that are solid names that should do well, whose fundamentals are continuing to improve. And this environment, which is very liquid, is going to allow for things like, you know, a 30-plus percent gain in one day. One other name this week that we had, they announced their earnings, was American Software. They do software products that have, they had a very strong quarter that they just announced, and they do software products that relate to supply chain optimization. So it's a very, you know, strong demand, but they're reporting, I guess, they made some changes to their accounting. Stock was up 39% yesterday. We have a full position in it, so we're quite happy. But again, here's a company that's solid, in the right place at the right time in terms of the business model. Fundamentals are really solid, and you're getting rewarded for it. So the, you know, the high-flying names that are, mean names that are having, like, these day-to-day moves, you could play that speculative game, or you can look at the fundamentals and get some pretty good returns, some very solid returns, based on the fundamentals. So I think we're in a very good environment right now, very strong environment with a lot of liquidity. I still believe in the infrastructure play. You know, names that we've mentioned before continue to trade up, like MasTec, Matson, you know, Aztec, which does asphalt materials, is helped, you know, it's held back a little bit, and so I think there's room in ASTE. SWM is another name that, you know, is an infrastructure name that we like. Brady, BRC, another name that we think has potential. But these names are all up like 30, 40, 50%. Some of them have come back a little bit, so we do think there's still room. Now, Federal Signal and Manitex that are there in the Chicago area, I think, are also good names, FSS and MMTX. So the infrastructure play, you know, despite what you hear on the political side, it's going to happen, and it is happening already, and this is going to be a trend that's going to continue, I believe, for the next few years, a positive trend. You know, we've seen improvement across many sectors, especially when you're looking at real estate. You know, we've seen a really big push this past week in some nice gains in REITs, including our self-storage REIT, SELF, and I should say our investment in that REIT. We don't own it, but we're, you know, NDNQ is up over 100 now. So there's a lot of positive movement in this direction, and I think for investors, you really can't get teased or you know, blindsided or look at the appeal of, you know, of an AMC when you've got names that are going to be good long-term holdings, you know, that are giving you 30%+ in a day or two. So those names are out there, and that's I think a, you know, a plug for our fundamental approach and how in this environment we're not necessarily being left behind. In fact, we're outperforming considerably this year. Just one other name that has come up because it's been so difficult with bonds, you know, yields, as you see, the 10-year is trading down, but every yield on the fixed income side, whether it be in treasuries, government agencies, mortgages, they're all trading down. Corporates, high yield, emerging markets, the spreads are tightening. But we did find a name, Genworth, which is a financial services name. And for those that are have a little stronger stomachs, they have 2-year bonds that are trading close to par, but they're giving you 5%, 4.90%. And in this environment, that's pretty attractive. We're not anticipating any, you know, anytime soon that we're going to see, hikes in rates. You know, so for the near term, a 5% yield for 2 years looks pretty good.
Well, Dan, how long do you think, I'm kind of leading the witness here, but how long do you think that I'm watching my emails here because I had a call from one of the other guys that manages money in one of the places with me, and he's had big moves up in his. He's had a couple of preferreds, and they've had big moves up. And I guess I'm sure as hell not going to debate anybody on whether you want to be in this stuff. You do. I mean, you need to be, but you're also the better. The gravy gets, and the gravy's getting pretty damn good. There's a lot of things I think you need to be aware of. When the Fed, I won't say if, when the Fed realizes they've totally botched this whole deal, they're going to come after this with a frenzy that people think they're going to be like 0.25%. When they start saying how gradual they'll be if they overshoot, God bless it. Man, I've seen these guys bring up, raise federal funds rate 3% in a month. You know, if you go back and, I mean, it, when they're out of control, it won't be gradual. So, yes, you want to be, the things you're talking about, I believe, again, maybe you'll agree or disagree, you're looking at companies and you've done your homework up to, say, 80% of the way, and now you're going to really benefit from this because the company that you think was fairly valued before and paying, making money and sending people a dividend, whether it's preferred or regular, that company, all of a sudden, somebody else is going to look at it and say, hey, these bleeps don't even realize they could raise their prices 25% the next year, and they're going to make a fortune. I mean, I know I've been early, I've been wrong in the gold and the GDX stuff, but I also know that if gold goes to 2,000, which isn't very far away, it's 5%, and with money doing what it's doing, but I also know that if that happens, the GDX profit for those firms, they're going to go up 20%. Just like the stuff you're talking about. There's a lot of firms that you were talking in the asphalt business or whatever. I'm not going to say the particular firm that you have, are in basic materials. You know, I'm putting down concrete on a Dan Ryan and I'm making a 15-20% return. All of a sudden, these guys are going to pay me 20% more. My return doesn't go up 20%, it's going to double, right? So, I mean, what we're seeing is an avalanche of money pouring into the system. Now, the cynic would say the price of your company hasn't gone up a dime. The value of the dollar has just gone down 40%, and you're just keeping pace. That would be the monetarist cynic, which I am. Because you know, last year, we're talking about the last 12 months, we're talking about a 25% increase in the money supply. With every indication, it's going to be there again this year. So the fact that everything we own, the card, everything is going to be up 50% is not something. The problem is for some people, and the benefit is for the places you found, because you found guys who were doing good in the old system.
Right.
Some place, we're not all going to go up 50%. Some people are going to go up 10, and some people are going to triple. So I think you've done a nice job for all the wrong, I won't say the wrong reasons, for totally different reasons, have probably identified people that are in the double to triple range, even though that's not what you were trying to do.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I think some of it is we kind of do a worst case scenario analysis, so we're already taking into account, you know, if we were to see hiking interest rates prior to you know, or like you're suggesting, like, you know, more, you know, getting much more on the rate side, you know, kind of a surprise increase, a couple of surprise increases that are going to, but those increases would first impact and have, as we can tell this year, anticipation of any kind of increase is going to first affect mostly the tech names and the high flyers, and it certainly will have effect on all stocks, but I think there'll be, I think the timing of all of this is what's going to be important. And the word right now, and what we're seeing, I think, pretty much across the board, and certainly in Europe as well, is really no action. I don't know what it's going to take on the CPI side. I really don't even know if it matters at this point, where if it comes in at 4.7 or 5%, or I'm not sure how much, if they're really looking there. I mean, certainly on the job side, we're getting back to, you know, the full employment numbers fairly quickly, and we're seeing, you know, huge demand for workers across the board in different industries. So that's all very positive. As we talked before, again, if we can go back to pre-COVID and we looked at what were the things everyone was talking about, and one of them was wages, and we were waiting for wage increases, and we are going to see them. I think they're going to be gradual. I don't know that they're going to be extreme. I think some of the states, including Florida, that has raised the minimum wage is doing it over a period of years. And certainly they're going to pass on some of that to, like you say, the pricing power that they have with their customers, whether it be retail or industrial, commercial. It's going to, you know, that's what's going to happen to the companies that are well run. And also the companies that have been focused on free cash flow and well managed. So that, you know, again, it goes a lot to the management of the companies and their focus, and also their, you know, if they're ready, or if they're in a situation where they're prepared for a change. The cyclical companies tend to do well because they've been through this before and they know how to manage tough times that could be ahead. But we don't see those tough times anytime soon. So they're going for the ride right now. We're going to go along with it.
Oh, I think you've got it exactly. The only difference between my point of view and yours and a lot of the other people that come on the show is that I am, because I was around in those days, I think it crumbles. I think by Labor Day, we could conceivably have a country that has zero credibility with this Fed. If not Labor Day, certainly by Thanksgiving. I mean, how much more can you listen to somebody tell you there's no inflation when it's like 10%, yeah, for God's sake? I mean,
yeah, and I mean, I think that's where you have to really, you know, as a portfolio manager and a financial advisor, you have to really, from the experience that we have in this, you know, like 3.5 decades of experience in this industry, you have to look at what you see right in front of you and know that this is going to have an impact. And I guess the other place that I get the information is directly from the, you know, CEOs of the companies we manage, and when they're seeing it and they're talking about it, and you know, it's real and not necessarily concerned, because in a lot of cases they're passing it through, but it's happening. It's out there. It's happening. It's, you know, it's across the board, and it's not in, like I said, it's not just in the retail space. It's in the commercial industrial space. And
Well, the gentleman I was talking to yesterday, and I think you know what I'm talking about, but I won't lob any names out here. He's got a couple of preferreds that are up 40 or 45%. And I think you guys, you more than him, have done the homework to find these places that are really going to benefit from, even if it's short-term inflation. But I also think that you guys are smart enough to say, he says, well, it's up 40%. What do you think I should do? I said, sell it.
I mean, right, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Yeah.
So I've made, you know, we more than trimmed, let's put it this way, on the news in both of these companies that I mentioned, the U.S. Concrete and American Software. So that's exactly what you do. And that's part, the sell discipline, I think, is really hard in this business, and I think it's particularly hard for an individual to do that on their own. And I think, like, this is where, years of experience, where we see what happens, and we know that, you know, we're not emotionally attached to a name. We can't get emotionally attached to a name. We might like the name, the management and all that, but we have to know when to start trimming and to start cutting and moving on to other names. So fortunately, there's enough names that are coming through, and at least this has been a fun environment to manage money because everything isn't going up all at once. You know, day to day, there are names that have been, that have sold off a little here and there, and we still have strong conviction. So we have, plenty of places to put money to work at this point.
Well, I think you do, and I think there's a lot of companies that are going to be forgotten. I admit that I put too much into the gold and silver because I thought it would spout out there like it did before. But it seems I still think it probably will. But there's no doubt I could have waited on that stuff. I mean, I could have buy the stuff you're buying, wait till it goes up 40%, and then put it in the stuff I think is going to go up. But maybe the Bitcoin, maybe the other stuff has taken some of the luster from the gold and stuff. That could be it. I mean, I don't know what it is, but clearly they're a little slow. I don't know if there's a liquidator someplace. There could be, you know, I mean, who knows?
I think the gold and silver, I mean, we have good sized investments in gold and silver as well. And I think they're always going to be a good diversifier. I mean, it's going to always be a good place to be in your portfolio. And there's, they don't necessarily respond, or they're not responding, like you said, as we anticipated they would. However, if you look at, you know, at the cycles of gold and silver, that they often tend to take off when everything else isn't looking good, and then you're kind of happy that you've made that investment. Then you're happy you got in early.
Well, the Fed's manipulating everything else. It wouldn't surprise me if they're not manipulating that too, right? I mean,
yeah.
I just think that this is, I don't want to see the ramifications, and one thing I know about inflation is that it's never even. And for half the population, it's the cruelest tax there is. For other people, they think it's great, you know. And it's we don't need another income, you know, something that separates income out again, like we've had for the last how many years. And the last thing we need is yet another thing that takes the 1%. Now, do you really think that the people who are wouldn't you like to see, Dan? I don't know, maybe you can actually find it. You've got more connections than me. Wouldn't you like to see somebody get on TV and not spend, you know, 4 hours on it because it puts us all to sleep, but an hour and just read off the high points of this $250 million bill? And who's going to get all this money? We got five makers of, maybe not even that, of chips? And it's $250 billion? I mean, for God's sake, what are we going to give them, $50 billion apiece so they can, these are the guys that took it to China in the first place? I mean,
right, no, exactly. And you know, I think that so much of the talk ends up becoming political and less sort of on where the need is. And that's why I still go back to that, you know, you have to have a little bit of faith, not necessarily in, you're not going to be able to have a lot of faith in the decision makers all the time, but I think in the system and knowing that at some point down the road, that, you know, roads need to get fixed, bridges need to get repaired. You know, we've got stuff going on right here that needs to be fixed. Our whole internet system needs to be upgraded. You know, it's a competitive thing, I think, to stay competitive with the rest of the world. And so that's, I think, most likely to happen. How we get there is going to be, you know, it could be entertaining, or we can just kind of like barrel through and just say it's going to happen and not really pay attention to the noise coming on the, you know, the day-to-day noise that we hear from Washington. So
which would you rather be, a guy like me who tries to take his 40 years of economics experience and piece together patterns and look for trends and things like that, or a guy like you who works his fanny off going after firms and trying to find the right ones, or just be a government staffer who knows what's named in his bill ahead of everybody else?
I think I'd be bored in the third third case. I mean, a combination of the first two, I think, is the best.
You'd be bored going out and buying yachts every week? I don't know.
Not necessarily buying yachts every week, but I mean, I think I'd have to have some sort of mental stimulation. So.
Oh, me too. But you had another new yacht. You had another girlfriend just on this yacht. I got five of these now. It's starting to get boring. I mean,
I live here in Florida. I've had boats for a long time. It's a great hobby and it's fun and everything. But after a while, you kind of miss the business. You want to know what's going on. So it's a nice break, but it's all about balance.
Did you ever read? Actually, I read three quarters of it because my mother told me the ending, and I didn't finish it. Bonfire of the Vanities years ago.
Yes. Yeah.
Remember, the guy'd sit there, and his wife did nothing but give him grief, then he'd go over to the girlfriends, and as soon as he walked in the door, she started to give him grief, and I'm thinking, as soon as I read that book, I'm like, the last thing I need is a wife and a girlfriend. My God, why would anybody double up on this? Or with two guys? Why would a girl want two guys, for God's sake?
Exactly, yeah. No, I agree. Why complicate life,
Well, Dan, I think what you're finding, I think there's actually probably more of these companies around. I bet you're finding more now, especially since these prices are more. Some companies, how can I put this? The way their variable costing is set up, and I think you know enough about this to dig into it. Some companies, if you raise their prices 10%, depending on what they do, you raise their profits 10%. Others, you raise the prices 10%, you raise the profits 30%.
Right.
I mean,
Yeah, and that's where productivity does come in and has helped. And that's also where really good management has helped as well. And that's, when we're looking at companies, we're looking at the business model. We're looking at strategic vision going forward, but we're looking at the model that's put together, the positive cash flow that comes out of their current business. And their potential for organic growth, they're not strictly relying on getting out there and buying the next, making the next acquisition, because they may not be able to if prices get too high. But we're looking at companies that are able to manage within their own system and keep costs down. And companies have done a lot of companies have done a good job at that. And I find that these smaller companies almost have to if they want to compete. So the small and micro companies that want to make it in this world, even if they have a niche product, they have to really pay attention. And the ones that pay attention do a really good job. Because they know they're not going to be winners. They're not going to come out of this, because there's enough competition in our system to weed them out. So.
Well, one of the ways you become a winner is because some of your suppliers are losers. They can't raise their prices.
Right.
I mean, no matter who you are, if you're buying 15, I'll use the term factors of production. I shouldn't be doing that at early in the morning. If 12 of them are in a super competitive area or somebody's trying to do something, gain market share or whatever, keeping his price down, and everybody else, you're raising your stuff 10%, and all of a sudden, 30% of your supply guys raise it 5%, well, put you 15% to the good, right?
Right.
So, you definitely want to be in the win column on this and not the losers.
Right. It's how much money you're willing to put out there initially, and that's sort of why we tend to shy away from some of the single product biotech names or some of the tech names that are, kind of relying on what's going on in the future. I've been in a conference the last few days and listening to a lot of biotech and, not a lot, but listening to a few biotech names that sound really interesting. But then when you start thinking about the capital they have to put out initially and they don't really have a plan for recapturing that, they're just saying, yeah, we have this great product that's going to do great things and we're pumping more and more money into it. But they don't really have a plan yet set up for how they're going to capture that, and how they're going to manage the company going forward to be profitable and grow their business.
Well, Dan, when you first came on the show, it's been like a year or so now, when you came up with somebody who was 5 or 6% on a preferred, that was like manna from heaven. And now if this number today comes out like people think it's going to come out, it's like, maybe I should wait. I'll get more. I mean, it's happened pretty fast.
Yeah, and the more is coming on the capital appreciation side.
Well, the more is going to come on these interest. I mean, Fed says, you and I know that 5% is not as good as it was a year ago.
True.
I mean, right? It's just very interesting stuff. But we're going to have to get a spot where we keep track of the names you put out, and we have to post them every week, because I'm starting to get a lot of calls for them, and I have to go back and listen.
Sure. So we're going to have to. More than happy.
We'll do that, buddy. You take care of yourself, and talk to you next week. SP Futures up 50 cents, NASDAQ Futures up down 27 with a CPI number. And we're going to have Mr. Chris Conlon. He was on a long time ago. He's got interesting programs on Predict Recessions. This will be very interesting. He was a great guest last time, and I'll bet he'll be better this time. Be right back.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck, get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. At PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, owner of HomeSource Realty and frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks radio show. If you're thinking about purchasing real estate this summer, could be a good time to shop around. Whether you're a novice or seasoned investor, low interest rates and good inventory make adding bricks and mortar investment to your portfolio an interesting possibility. Many a great fortune has begun with the purchase of property. Call me today for your personal investment consultation, and I would be happy to get you started on your path to prosperity. You can reach me at AudreyJohnson@Realtor.com or call me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Ollies, Mr. Dave Satina, and aboard. SP Futures down 6, NASDAQ Futures down 69. The tail of the CPI numbers is 0.7, which is higher than anybody thought. It's supposed to be 0.5. Ex-food and energy is 0.6. Is that right, David? I have that right, or that back, I have it back, backwards? Since last May, it's 5%, and we know somewhere in the next hour or two we're going to have, what, three or four of our employees come out and say they just can't make it back to 2%, and yet it's 5? And we're paying these people, David? It just goes crazy into me. Like I say, SP Futures down 6. SP Futures down 69 over in Europe. Again, these are probably a little bit delayed here, but the DAX down 5. All that fat FTSE up 17.2%. CAC around down 20.3%. This is just after, on the last break, we talked about the European Central Bank continuing their bond buying and keeping their interest rates unchanged because they just can't get back to 2% inflation. I just don't get it. Asia, Nikkei up 97 bucks, 0.3%, Shanghai up 19.5, Hang Seng down 3, call that flat. We've got bonds, 1.51, that's actually positive 0.2, although I have the TLT racing down now after the numbers, so I actually have the current TNX is 1.51, so it's a little higher, it's actually up 0.27. We've got oil, 13 cents, 70.09. Brent up 21 cents, 72.43. Natural gas up 2 cents, 3.15. RBOB up a penny to 221. We've got gold actually going down here, which is kind of surprising. 1879 down 16 bucks, silver down 21 cents, 2778, copper down 6 cents, 443, and we have Bitcoin up 1400 bucks, 37,583. David, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Are we done with this eclipse or no?
We are. 7:34 in Chicago. Weather today. Currently it's 72 and sunny. It's going to be a nice day. 78 for the high. For our Phoenix listeners, it's 76 and clear, and it's going to be 102 and mostly sunny. Traffic, I-80 still a little messed up from the early reaction. I-80 east between Ridge Road and exit 122. It's backed up to Manuka Road due to a rollover semi. Slowdowns due to long-term construction on the Kennedy and Eisenhower as usual. Solid traffic on I-55 north at the Ryan exit every day. And there's a crash on 94 west before 79th Street involving a semi. Right lane is blocked. In sports, the NBA playoffs, the Suns take a 2-0 lead, defeating Denver 123-98. In Major League Baseball, last night the Sox lose to the Blue Jays 6-2. The Cubs beat the Padres 3-1. Diamondbacks drop another one, losing 4-0 to the A's. PGA, we have the Palmetto Championship in South Carolina this weekend. Back to you, Chief.
We have Mr. Chris.
Yes, can you hear me all right?
Hey, Chris, how are you, buddy? It's been a while. Chris Conlon, president of Conlon Scientific. How are you?
Good. It's good to be back with you, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
I understand that you were the first buyer of AMC. You were the first buyer of GameStop, and you're reeling it in.
You're underestimating my age, for sure.
God, the crazy stuff, huh? But you say you've been doing some research on when recessions start and when they stop, and that's got to be fascinating stuff, and that you found some pretty interesting stuff, and gave us a buzz, and I'd love it. I don't know why we haven't had you back anyway, but because we had good stuff last time. But what have you been doing with yourself? What's so interesting?
Hey, good question. So for some context, for listeners who probably don't remember me, my shop uses big data and machine learning to pick stocks. And naturally, we would want to start to understand when recessions are coming, because if we're running a stock portfolio, when the recession is about to come, we probably want to be net short. That has presented a huge data collection challenge for us and forced us to think about impending recessions now and recessions that have happened in the past and tell those stories from a new perspective. We're thinking about who had access to the important information before the recessions occurred. And the lessons go all the way back to the Great Depression.
Really?
Absolutely. The big overriding principle about recessions that I'm sure you're all familiar with, and these are financial recessions, not economic recessions. Before the financial recession, when the stock market starts to crash, you usually have investors levered up or overexposed to risky assets. The pinprick pops the bubble, and people have to unravel all of those risky positions. They start to have ripple effects into other sections of the financial industry. That causes the financial recession. So, for example, the Great Depression, it was studied very thoroughly. Everyone knows the what and the why of how it happened. But what I think people don't appreciate is that margin lending was basically created in the U.S. 5 years ahead of the Great Depression, or margin trading was created. They had a different name for it then. It was called call loans because there were high interest rate loans that supposedly the bank could just call back at any time if they needed money for something more more stable or backed by better assets. Essentially, if the bank needed a real estate loan, they would call back your margin loan immediately. We have data on this now. You know, we know how people were accumulating margin in 1923 through 1929 ahead of the burst of the Great Depression.
Chris, there was no slippage on the margin either, right? I mean, now if you borrow, you can borrow at 50%, but you don't have to maintain 30. They had their margin was more like a futures thing now, where it's a good faith deposit, where if you lost money, you had to pony up that day, correct?
Exactly. There was the market for margin lending was more crude in a number of different ways. You know, right now you can sign up for a brokerage account, and as long as you have $10,000, they'll give you $40,000 to buy the S&P index. But it was much more bespoke, and there were less technological levers to control it back then. But that's the thing I don't think people appreciate, is because there were less technological levers, because there was less regulation, because the government wasn't regulating margin caps like they do today, the margin debt in the U.S. heading into the Great Depression, it doubled year over year heading into the Great Depression all the way up to 1929. And by the time the bubble popped and people started unwinding their margin loans, the amount of margin that people had was a significant percentage of GDP.
Well, I don't know if your research goes back far enough. I don't know why you would, but one rainy day, I was digging into the tulip mania. And what you just said is absolutely, there was the run on the tulips, then they got exchanged, they got listed on the exchanges of the time, and then the final straw was we were able to margin them. And then about 6 months later, they all collapsed. So it went back even further than 1929. As soon as it becomes marginable. Well, first it was exchange listed, and then it was marginable.
Wow.
So is Bitcoin next? We'll get it on an exchange, and then we'll let people borrow to get it, and then that'll happen there, or what?
Exactly. Well, we're kind of skipping to the end of the story.
Right, okay.
There are some parallels. The problem with the Great Depression is that, you know, it's one of the most significant financial events in history. Everyone studied it. Everyone has data now. There's so much research that you can pour over and try to understand what happened. But as a machine learning engineer, I don't care about what data exists about the Great Depression. I care about what data people had in 1929.
Okay, that makes sense.
So what I'm finding is that, you know, in 1929, no one had access to the numbers on how much margin debt the U.S. public had. If you wanted to collect that information, there was no spreadsheet. The federal government had no spreadsheet. The Federal Reserve didn't have any spreadsheet. So if you wanted to get that number and start to estimate it, the people that knew what was going on were the ones with a ton of bank connections that could just call up 10 banks in their black book and ask them, you know, hey, how much margin debt have you originated? Like, what's the trend? You say it's doubling year over year? I've heard that from 10 other banks. Then you start to get the picture of the actual risk, because these numbers were compiled as a sort of a post-mortem. We have this data as a post-mortem analysis of what transpired before the Depression.
Okay, Chris, let me fill in the blanks for the listeners, because you're a tad ahead of them. Right now, the margin amounts, how much you can borrow, are controlled by the Fed. They set the 50% initial margin and 30% maintenance margin. Before, when Chris is talking about, banks were free to set their own numbers, so it became a competitive thing, where now it really isn't. You can't borrow more at Schwab, for instance, than you can at Fidelity, than you can at PTI. It's all the same number. But back then, so because the Fed's sort of involved, there's a central clearinghouse of information. So you can go to the New York Stock Exchange site, and it will tell you what the margin is, I don't know if it's weekly or daily, on borrowed stock. And Chris is saying that was not available back then. And it was a competitive thing. You might be able to get 50% in one place and 45% in another, right, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, people would compete on interest rates. They'd compete on multiples. Smaller banks would say, hey, get away from that bigger bank, because I'll give you a higher multiple.
So how were you able to get all that info now?
It's all estimates.
Okay.
We have examples of how people struggled to get this info from 2008, because in 2008, there was a bunch of regulation, a bunch of technological infrastructure. Data was still a big thing in 2008. People were monitoring and modeling these things. But you had the same problem. People created or chased high-risk levered instruments. You know, we've all heard about mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations nonstop for the past decade and a half. But people created those assets, and they were investing in them. And even the top dogs the guys at the federal government, Federal Reserve, and the top hedge funds in the world could not figure out how many of these things existed or what the net exposure of any given company was to these new instruments, the mortgage-backed securities, for example. So it was still a data problem in 2008, even with all the regulation.
So let me put a much more nefarious view on that. If the people who were supposed to be watching this stuff actually were watching it, which they weren't, they would have had a problem compiling the data, is what you're saying. If they actually cared, if they actually cared, they might have had trouble doing it. I'm saying they didn't even care. I mean, they had no. You know what? Some of the stuff, though, Chris, I'll allow this one at you because you and I like to go back and forth with you because I remember the last time we did. I think that the Fed in 2008, one thing they should have been able to figure out that you and I could never. The interest rates here that people were going gaga over on these mortgage loans were 6.5%. There's nothing you and I would run down the block for. So the question is, why were people so anxious to get it? The answer, I think, was people were borrowing at 1% over in Japan and leveraging it over here and not doing the forward contract back. So everybody was making 4.5% on the spread. Now, I got to believe that the Fed had to know that those loans were being taken in Japan and the money was being deposited here. They had to. How could they not know that or not look at that? How is it not available to them?
It's a good question. The simple explanation would be that the Fed can see the currency exchanges, right? They can see the Japanese investors
right.
Going long dollars. And they expect them to do that in order to escape the low interest rate environment of Japan over that 20-year period. They can see them doing that, but I think the benevolent explanation is that the Fed incorrectly assumed that the Japanese retail investors were going for the carry trade, just trying to protect them, because the interest rates in the U.S. in 2006, 2007 were still about 2 points above the interest rates in Japan. So they just assumed it was the carry trade all over again. They didn't think that those institutional investors were, or those retail and institutional Asian investors, it was a lot of Chinese investors too, they didn't think that they were pouring those long dollars into mortgage-backed securities, but they clearly were.
Okay, were they blind? I mean, you don't know the answer to that question, but I'm like...
Exactly.
For God's sake, yeah, one other... By the way, I'm impressed with what you have, and I'm learning from it. I don't know if you ever read Freedom from Fear by William Kennedy, and he has kind of a history of the Depression and World War II. And... he brings up, and he doesn't know anywhere near the numbers that you do, but he brought up that the thing in 29, the depression or the crash and so forth that led directly into, well, he goes, it really was, if you looked at all the numbers of the people, he said the agricultural area and some other areas was in a depression already for 10 years. He goes, half of your population, maybe more, was already in a depression. That the numbers... that you and I see, the gross numbers, I think it's very similar to today. It was a very small percentage of population with the numbers piling up, and a lot of the numbers are piling up because of stock market increases and, automobiles going up in value, but certainly houses and those kinds of things. And that there really was no, once this happened, it wasn't like the regular person had a full fridge, money in the bank and everything else. They were already destitute. Rural America was already in a depression. Did any of that come out, or are you looking at just kind of the gross numbers?
I'm looking at mostly financial recessions. That's there, and that's part of the desperation that causes people to lever up on risky assets. Is when when half the country is in sort of an economic depression, they're not exactly prospering. That creates some of the desperation that causes them to pour into risky assets, which really increased the total exposure to mortgage-backed securities, more or less.
Well, I think right now, and again, this is just one comment because I'm more interested in what you have to say. I listen to myself every day. I think it's very similar to now. I think an amazing percentage of our population, I'm going to read 60%, hasn't really gotten a raise since 2000. I mean, or certainly since 2008. They've not kept up with any sort of inflation or any sort of thing, and I think we're almost in the same boat. That if we that the thing holding us together is the market and other things. And if all of a sudden that were to collapse now, I think we're right back where we were, hopefully not as bad, as in 1930.
Well, there's the fun part, is we get to start looking at exposure to risky assets nowadays, all of the unregulated assets people are in now, and sort of compare them to past financial recessions.
And what have you found?
You brought up Bitcoin right at the beginning,
okay.
And you're right. I mean, the market cap of crypto is $1.7 trillion right now, even after Bitcoin fell from its 60,000 high. Under conservative, we don't have any way of knowing this, really. People can analyze blockchain. They can analyze the ledgers. People have decent estimates. The brokerages know things. Let's conservatively say that 25% of that crypto float is held by U.S. investors, and let's simulate a shock of the whole value of the crypto market falling 70% for some reason. Well, when you talk about those losses as a percent of GDP, that's a negative wealth effect of around $250 billion. And as a percent of GDP, that's basically the pinprick that started the Great Recession, the Great Depression.
Okay.
You have all of a sudden, all at once, avalanche of wealth loss of around 1% of GDP. That's like the pinprick that can start the ripple effect of everyone unraveling their positions, and you could create a financial recession in the stock market. So that's what's scary to me now, is that certain parts of crypto and crypto as a whole is big enough that it exposes so many U.S. investors to credit tightness or cash tightness, that if you see crypto liquidating on a massive scale and destroy all this wealth, you might see wealth get destroyed in the stock market because those people need to liquidate their portfolios to pay bills.
What when you look at this, I mean, obviously, you guys do an awful lot more than just this. It's just kind of a special project. What's the difference? How can I say this without leading the witness? When you look at the other day, Zoom had earnings, and as I've mentioned this on the show, I never give investment advice or anything like that, but I have been looking into some of these companies that are high flyers. It seems like every stock I look at from one of my clients now is, because I don't really do these on my own for them, but sometimes clients bring them in, they might have some Zoom, and I look at it and I go, Jesus Christ, this thing is trading 375 and earnings, their revenue is like 8. Like that sounds like 99 numbers. And I didn't start out doing that research, but I can't help myself because I'm like you. I got to ask the next question, right? You look at these things, and their earnings were like $1.60 in the best year they're ever going to have last year. And I'm just like, what's the difference between a stock? I mean, literally, I'm going to say if you and I, again, this is not any, do not short it because it'll probably be up today. You and I look at this, we wouldn't be interested in it if it was $40, let alone $375. And in 1999, I mean, as you probably recall or have read, the QQQ, which is the high price stock, or the high price stocks, the NASDAQ stocks, went from 120 to like 20. So it went down even further than you're talking about Bitcoin going down. I mean, it's not just, I mean, that's what I'm saying, the wealth creation. When I was a kid, and David's not that much younger, your uncles made wealth by making $100 a week, living fairly comfortably on 80, and putting 20 in a bank. That's not anywhere near the program now. It's having some stock trading 375. It's never going to pay you a dividend ever. I guess there's not much of a reach between that kind of a stock and Bitcoin, which has nothing. I mean, they almost got nothing. It seems to me
exactly. And, well, fortunately, what is Zoom's market cap? Around $500 billion right now?
Yeah, some huge
number. That's pretty comparable to the float of Bitcoin, and then it's a third of the whole crypto market in general. I certainly know I'm back in the office and scaling down all of our Zoom subscriptions, so you're 100% right that it's been their best year ever.
I'm not picking on them. I'm looking at, you look at SHOW, you look, there's got to be 50 of them I look at every week. I'm going, God, you know. Well, Cisco in 99 was trading over $60, and they were $5 a share in revenue. And the thing went down to $6.50, didn't it, or something like that? I mean, it's not like
it looks like it looks like the Great Depression a little bit, and then it also looks like Germany post World War One. There was a huge run up in the stock market in Germany post World War One. And the only reason that people were in stocks, they didn't know why the stocks would go up. They just knew that the monetary base was increasing, that the CPI was going up, inflation was running, hyperinflation was getting its teeth into things. And all they knew is that if they weren't in the stock market, they would get inflated out of all of their wealth.
Right. Well, by the way, if you probably have already done this, but check Argentina, Venezuela, and Turkey. You find the same story. Iran, too. There's four countries in the last 30 years. Gives you the exact same picture.
Exactly. Well, if you're a teacher or if you're a construction worker and you make a salary or you make an hourly wage, your wage isn't inflation indexed, but the stock market is.
Right. Well, that's how do you explain that? If you know, without being doggy downer, which you don't, you know, I don't want to be. How do you explain even the simple stuff? Okay, we put 25% more money in the system last year, and the market's up 25%. I mean, duh. I mean, it might be the market going up. It might be the dollar going down. Right? And maybe Apple hasn't really gone up at all in relation to anything else. It's the dollar that's moving. It's the quicksand under our feet that's moving. It's not us growing.
Exactly. I mean, increasing the monetary base, printing money, putting out these infrastructure bills, and giving the handouts, so to speak, it is really the government investing in the population, and they can make a bad investment, like they can make a bad loan. If that loan doesn't result in real output in excess of the nominal interest rate, if it doesn't result in output growth in excess of the nominal interest rate to repay that money, then it was a bad investment, and we might very well be seeing negative returns on that loan from the U.S. government.
Chris, how do you, here's something that always, well, I've been around here a while, always gets me crazy about the business, and the ultimate curiosity is, when you look at all the statistics you guys are piling up, you probably know more about the Great Depression now at this point than virtually anybody with the numbers you guys have dug up. Why did it happen on that Monday and not a week before a week? What is the trigger point? Why did the crash of 87 happen on that day? Why did, and I think you could look at the stuff in, 2000, it was when the Fed turned around from the Y2K stuff, but even so, how do you, I mean, you and I kind of agree on the generalities of where it looks like we're heading here, but how do you pick a day to where all of a sudden today's the day I want to short the bonds and short the market or whatever, or buy pounds or something instead of get rid of the dollar? What causes it to turn? Is it an announcement? Is it a number? Is it a policy?
Think about the role of a financial wealth manager that manages his client's money. He's a financial intermediary or a middleman. He's not necessarily investing his own capital, but he's taking his client's money, putting it in the market, trying to get growth for them. His clients, who are households primarily, they aren't stalking the news like we are. They aren't stalking the Washington policy developments like we are. They aren't really keeping their ear to the ground. They're mostly following the advice of their financial intermediaries. They're hearing things on the news, they call their financial intermediary, the wealth manager, and then they react. What I see when the bubble pops is usually when an informed financial professional, a group of informed financial professionals, like all the wealth managers, they see a policy decision that signals a huge reversal in posture, that signals that the federal government or the government of whatever country is going to start tightening. They're going to raise interest rates, and they have an agenda to start tightening. They think things are too hot, and they want to fight inflation. Once the financial intermediaries get that idea, and they start reinforcing their clients' anxiety about incoming recessions, it just all starts to unravel.
So you can sort of see it coming a little bit, but you can't really predict the day.
Yeah, you can't predict the day because it will be an announcement, and the first things to go will be like the call loans in 1929, or it will be like the mortgage-backed securities in 2008. It's when the financial intermediaries, the middlemen, start to get the sense that the free money flow is over, that the government's going to start tightening, that cascading flow of information down to the clients just causes mass liquidation, and it's compounded by the people that are there's mom and pop that are just long only unleveraged in, you know, S&P 500 stocks. They're not risky. They're not levered up too much, but the people in crypto right now, or the people in meme stocks right now,
they aren't levered.
They're really hurt by this.
We got a dash here, Chris. I want to have you back. So I don't think mom and pop are levered to the extent that you and I define leverage, but it's most of their wealth. So on a personal level, they're very levered.
That's a very good point.
Take care of yourself, buddy. I found this fascinating. Have you back soon if it's okay with you. S&P futures up 12 now. NASDAQ futures up 16. We love inflation. We'll be right back tomorrow morning. Stocks and Jacks.
What did we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
I don't know either. I guess we learned not to do it again.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to PTISecurities.com. PTI ProDirect. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at PTIProDirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit Nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.